It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, NPR's Stephen Thompson shares the songs that helped show him the futility of being a music snob.
But first, a plant that can cause blisters, scars, and even permanent blindness sounds like something straight out of a scary science fiction story. But it turns out that giant hogweed, wild parsnip, and other non-native toxic plants are here in Wisconsin.
Our next guest is on the front line in the effort to control and eradicate some of these invaders. Tom Ward is the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Manitowoc County Lakes Association. He's been working for years to control a population of giant hogweed in that part of the state. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be on the line today.
Well, Tom, I've seen headlines about this giant hogweed lately. I didn't realize we had it here in Wisconsin. You know firsthand we do. Talk about how nasty this stuff is if we come in contact with it.
Well, it's a real high-risk plant. It produces a sap that, if your skin is sweaty or perspired, makes contact with your bare skin and then is exposed to sunlight, will cause severe blistering and rash. Unlike, I think, the parsnip, the blistering can cause skin damage for up to 7 years and kind of cause skin sensitivity for that period of time. So it's a real dangerous substance, but it also can get in your eyes, and there's a risk of blindness.
Blindness from a plant.
Yeah, right.
So how prevalent is this here in Wisconsin?
Well, the first site started in Iron County, and they think it migrated across the border out of the UP in Michigan. And generally, they were brought in as ornamental plants just because they're so huge and large and, I suppose, a show plant to talk about because they're, I call them Frankenstein plants. And then the property here that showed up in Manitowoc County, apparently 15 or 10 years earlier, they were up running with ATVs up in the area that had plants. So either the seeds got onto the equipment or maybe their pickup truck. And then the property that the landowner owned in our county was an abandoned farm field. And it was just an opportunity for those seeds to drop off that vehicle and make soil contact and take off as a new infestation.
And what does this look like? Can you describe it for us?
Well, it's a plant that it can grow up to 20 feet tall, but if there's any grass competition, it'll still be 8 to 10 feet tall. It has a head, a flower head, that is white, and it's about as big around as a bushel basket. So it's pretty hard not to see it and wonder what it is. Now, this landowner saw it and didn't report it for 4 or 5 years, just not knowing what it was. But the leaves are extremely large. They can be up to 5 feet long. There's a native called cow parsnip that's a miniature version of it, but on the giant hogweed, many times the stalks are as large as your wrist or your arm.
Talking to Tom Ward, he's in Manitowoc County battling some invasive toxic plant species, things like giant hogweed and wild parsnip. Giant hogweed and wild parsnip, Tom, both invasive here in the state?
Yes, they are. A wild parsnip is spreading into our county just more recently. It's been a problem up in Door County, and it's commonly found on roadsides. It's a yellow plant, appears probably in July and August, and it's in the carrot or parsnip family.
And we've got a link, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page, some information and pictures, as you could see if you have these things in your yard, I should let you know. So, Tom, we know these things, as you said, are bad for us if we touch them. Like a lot of invasive species, do they cause problems for native species here in the state?
Well, they're both aggressive. The parsnip family sends down taproots, and in dry weather, I've seen it spread in our county here from the last 2 summers because we have a dry condition. And what happens is the natives kind of go dormant, and then these long taproot plants flourish, and so they really take off, and then that allows them to seed even more profusely and spread. And I think one of the risks that come with wild parsnip, it tends to grow along roadsides, and so people will get it up growing around their mailbox, And it's tempting then to grab the plant and go pulling it. And at that point in time, you can really expose yourself to the saps that are both reactive to sunlight.
Is there more of an effort being put into controlling giant hogweed and wild parsnip because, in addition to being invasive, they're so nasty for us to touch?
Well, in the giant hogweed, I just remain committed that we need to wipe it out right away before it spread in our county. So we've been treating it now for about 5 years, and we're finally, this year, I think the number of plants is dropping, but it's still a couple plants come up every year, and if you just let one go and go to seed, it's going to continue. On the wild parsnip, it becomes a road right-of-way issue. We have an example up in Door County where they are actually treating or herbiciding the plants up there. Other places are just kind of understanding what it is and not doing too much. I think if you mow it before it goes to seed, it would be a good thing. On the other hand, if you mow it after it's seeded or seeding, you spread it. So timing of mowing and maintenance on road right-of-ways is real critical.
Well, talk us through what you do to try to contain and eradicate a giant hogweed there in Manitowoc County.
Well, giant hogweed, we like to go out in May because it's such a large plant and it's so viciously green that you can spot it against the brown background. And that's the best time to find the new plants and put a herbicide on them, either Roundup, a glyphosate, or a 2,4-D product. I tend to like a 2,4-D, like a lawn killer, because it doesn't kill grasses, which is a good competitor. Don't be tempted to go cut the stalks down in July or August, because that's where risk can really get high if you start using cutters or scissors. Or I had a plant pop up on a lady's lawn, and of course she mowed it off, and the risk is, what if you were to go under there and clean your lawnmower off and get the sap on your hands, not remembering that you cut the plant off? So I really caution the landowners to be very careful with the hogweed, but we are very vigilant in getting at it early in the spring. And then another time, as you miss plants, so about July, you'll see that head sticking up. And then that's the second time to get it before it goes to seed.
And you suit up when you're dealing with this stuff, right?
Yes, I do. I wear a pair of coveralls, and I encourage people to do that with any kind of plant control, and especially if you're using herbicides, because that protects you both against the sap and the herbicide. So it's real important. And again, I don't encourage any cutting of the plants because that really increases the risk of that sap exposure.
If people see this giant hogweed in their yard, say, should they report it to somebody so we know where it is so we can try to track it and stop it?
Generally, there's a couple outlets. One, there are AIS coordinators like myself that could check it out. DNR has websites that you can go to report the plant. Cow parsnip is commonly reported here in our county. It's a very close look-alike. It gets about 6 feet tall. It also has the white head, but it's about the size of a paper plate, a 12-inch paper plate. So it's very, very close. I take them all serious because we have these sites, and the risk is birds can carry the seeds off and move it. And so I generally check them all out, but many times a discussion with somebody, you can sort out whether it's a cow parsnip or a giant hogweed.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for the time.
That's Tom Ward. He's the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator for the Manitowoc County Lakes Association.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest is a musical omnivore. He spreads the gospel of music far and wide at his job at NPR, where he's the editor and reviewer at NPR Music, a panelist on the podcast Pop Culture Happy Hour, and regular contributor of playlists from NPR called Songs We Love.
Stephen Thompson just posted a new Spotify playlist of country songs he fell in love with when he was working at a grocery store in Iola, Wisconsin for Songs We Love. Stephen, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's hear about it in your own words. How did this country music playlist come about?
Well, it all started, I mean, way before the age of Spotify itself, in the late 1980s when I worked at what was then an IGA in Iola. I guess it's now a Century. Things change. And I was a stock boy and also a snob. 15 years old and assumed that I knew that country music was obviously terrible. And of course, they played country over the loudspeaker system at the grocery store. And it was one of my first lessons in what I now describe as like understanding that snobbery is the enemy of joy. Over time, I found myself falling in love with song after song after song, and at first, a great song felt like an outlier, and pretty soon I realized, like, wait a second, I like country music, and over time, I drifted away from country a little bit, and only recently, with this influx of amazing records by artists like Casey Musgraves and Ashley Monroe and Chris Stapleton, have been getting back into it and realizing, like, all along, I still love it. And so, through the magic of Spotify, I put together this playlist of a bunch of my favorite songs that I listen to. So the playlist is called Grocery Store Country, because that's where I fell in love.
Well, at that grocery store, did you have a mental battle raging in your head? Like, oh, I like it. No, I can't like this. I like it. No, I can't like it. Something like that?
Well, I think that battle rages in the mind of every adolescent.
I was that way with Duran Duran, actually, now that I recall as a teenager.
Absolutely.
It's funny. It sounds like you snuck off to the back room to listen to it.
I did.
Something illicit.
I absolutely did. It was my vice. I was a goody two shoes as a teenager, and so my vice was to sneak back when a Lyle Lovett song came on and shirk work for 3 or 4 minutes.
So you told us earlier today, and we were talking about it here, we don't really talk that much about country music on Central Time, on public radio in general. Do you agree? We maybe give it short shrift.
I think that may be true, and over at NPR Music, we're constantly every time we fall in love with something, we're really extra gleeful about bringing it to the world because people don't expect it from us.
You mentioned Lyle Lovett. This is a song that has a special place in your heart. This is called "If I Had a Boat."
And if I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. We could all together go out on the ocean, set me up on my pony, on my boat. Now if I were all
Lyle Lovett there singing "If I Had a Boat." I admit this song is beautiful. The only thing that caught me, Stephen, was the logistics of riding the pony on the boat.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm down with it. What do you like about it?
Oh, I just love that song so much. I love the incredible simplicity of it, the cleverness, the warmth. It's so beautiful. And Lyle Lovett was one where just every time he put out a new song, I just flipped for it. I was like, who the heck is this guy? And as somebody, that's an artist I've never fallen out of love with. I've just every step of the way puts on one of the best live shows I've ever seen in my life. He is wonderful. But that particular song, that's when I would just go running to the back room to listen to.
Well, he's one country artist who had a big crossover appeal, I think. And here's another one on your playlist, Katie Lang with "I'm Down to My Last Cigarette."
The coffee's all gone and my eyes burn like fire. It's way past the hour when most folks retire. You told me you'd call me, but you haven't yet, and I'm down to my last cigarette.
So tell us Katie Lang and that song on your list.
Yeah, I mean, Katie Lang is, especially at that phase of her career, was just such a wonderful throwback to classic old country music that I think is basically unimpeachable. I think everybody would agree that classic country music is great. And so it was another artist where it was like, this is a really adventurous performer, and people think, a lot of people when they think of country music are thinking of something that's very conservative and very, just these very you can't stray from any kind of country music orthodoxy, but there's an enormous amount of adventurousness in that music. And Katie Lang is a perfect example. And then somebody who, after the late 1980s, you know, crossed over as a major star.
She sounds a little like Patsy Cline in that track to
me,
who I love.
Oh, absolutely.
Is she still making music?
Katie Lang?
Yeah.
Yeah, she, the last time I saw her perform just like on TV was at an Olympics ceremony when the Olympics were held in Canada. You know, she's a gigantic star there. So she's been putting out records for the last few years, and she's kind of part country, part, I think, like adult contemporary at this point. She doesn't necessarily get played on country radio at this point, but continues to make music and continues to have this absolutely transcendent voice.
And she did maybe the best ever James Bond song, Tomorrow Never Dies, and it got put at the end of the movie. It wasn't even the main theme, but that was just her big voice, and that was amazing.
I didn't know that was her.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, let's move on to another one on Stephen Thompson's country music grocery store country music playlist. Randy Travis, Forever and Ever. Amen.
I'm gonna love you
So a huge name in country music, Randy Travis, not one like Lyle Lovett and Katie Lang, who had that, you know, wider pop appeal, I think, Stephen.
Yeah, Randy Travis is straight up a country singer and a really, really, really good one. And that song is just gorgeous. I remember that was the song when I went to vacation in Wisconsin Dells as a teenager. They had these little booths where you could record karaoke, and I was like, this is it. I'm gonna record. You know, I'm gonna find out like how, you know, because you know your voice in your own head is different from the one that you hear out in the world. And so I recorded it thinking like this is gonna sound amazing. And it sounded like complete hot garbage, and that was when I realized that I would never ever be a singer.
I'm sorry for that story, Stephen. But
and Stephen, we found that recording, and here no, I wish.
Oh wow, that'd be worth
that would be something. Yeah.
Oh, it's no one's finding that recording.
Yeah, that is a song that I too was not a country music fan at that point. I have been at other times, and I still kind of find occasion to sing that at various points in my life. I'm surprised I haven't sung it yet, Rob, for various reasons around the office.
Yeah.
Probably, actually, maybe it's not
it'd
that
be
surprising.
Weird. Yeah, it'd be a little weird. But cool.
Yeah.
Break it out tomorrow.
Well, another country star that I love to this day that I got hooked on when I was a kid is Dolly Parton.
Oh,
and
sure.
You've got one here, Stephen, from your list. Why'd you come in here looking like that? Here's a listen.
Why'd you come in here looking like that in your cowboy boots?
About this one, Stephen?
I just love Dolly Parton, first of all. I mean, Dolly Parton as an artist, I mean, how many artists have her ability to convey playfulness and joy while also having this incredible access to the nerve center of your heart? She can sing heartbreak music incredibly well, but she is like, that song hits your like all your pleasure centers within the first like 2 seconds. she's a really, like, she's seen as this kind of camp figure, you know, like, oh, she's so silly, but my God, there's just this absolutely titanic amount of talent.
Yeah, nobody's got a voice like that. Nobody.
She's amazing. I love her so much.
Another one on your list, just performed in the state, actually, Steve Earle. Peter out at the front desk, I think, caught that show. Here's Steve Earle and Copperhead Road.
Well, my name's John Lee Pettimore. Same as my daddy and his daddy before. You hardly ever saw granddaddy down here. He only come to town about twice a year.
So Steve Earle and Copperhead Road.
Well, yeah, this was at least struck me at the time as like this was country music for rockers. You know, if you thought Bon Jovi was cool, like, you know, this was your gateway into country music. I mean, this Steve Earle record, this Copperhead Road record, is you know, it's country. It got played on country radio, which Steve Earle, you know, doesn't really anymore. But I mean, my God, that was how, you know, that was one thing that led me into country music, was like I fancied myself a rocker. You know, I bought a Copperhead Road on cassette, and suddenly it's like, wait, I'm buying country records now. that's who I am.
So Steve Earle was the gateway musician for you.
He was a gateway musician, definitely. Certainly, you could listen to Steve Earle and still feel cool. You didn't have to hide it from your rocker friends. The 80s. I had so much hair then.
Now, these are from the grocery store days back in the 80s. For a few years there, Stephen. And you're catching us up here on the latest because it's part of your job at NPR. Who do you recommend for right now if we want to listen to country music?
Well, a few artists. There's a guy named Chris Stapleton who just put out a terrific record. He has this gorgeous voice, a singer I really love. She performs in the Pistol Annies with Miranda Lambert, who's great. Her name's Ashley Monroe. She has a really good record right now called The Blade. But above all, probably my favorite of all, she put out my favorite album of the year a couple years ago and has another great one this year. Her name's Kacey Musgraves. And I think I brought a song called Biscuits, which is just this wonderful little mind your nosy beeswax anthem.
All right, well, we'll go out to the news with Biscuits. Stephen, briefly, is there any music snob left in you?
Oh, I'm sure somewhere, but I'm trying to extinguish it at all times.
All right, Stephen, thanks as always for joining us. A lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Stephen Thompson, editor and reviewer at NPR Music, panelist in the podcast Pop Culture Happy Hour. His country music playlist for Songs We Love on Spotify is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
Veronica Rickard on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Mind your own biscuits and life will be gravy.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll look at why bike fatalities are up in Wisconsin this year.
First, college students around the country are starting to return to campus to prepare for another school year. Last week, sexually suggestive banners hung at an Old Dominion University house where fraternity members lived reopened a national conversation about campus sexual assault culture. The signs read, quote, "Rowdy and fun. Hope your baby girl is ready for a good time. Freshman daughter drop off. And go ahead and drop off mom, too." There were similar signs hung in an off-campus house on move-in day for students at The Ohio State University as well this past weekend.
And we're taking your calls on this. What do you think could be done to help prevent sexual assault on college campuses? And what do you say about college sexual assault to your children, your grandchildren, as they head off for college? Have you yourself experienced sexual assault or violence on campus? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Carmen Hotvet joins us now. She's the Assistant Director for Violence Prevention at the End Violence on Campus Program for University Health Services at UW-Madison. Carmen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
We also have Michael Kimmel with us. He's Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies and Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities at Stony Brook University. Michael, welcome back.
Nice to be with you. Thanks.
And Carmen, we're going to start with you. Are the sexually suggestive signs that we just mentioned, are they a typical portrayal of the attitudes toward sex on college campuses? Is that fair to say?
Oh, that's a great question. And I think the attitudes about sex on college campus are probably really varied. But I think one thing that we know is that when all male groups do something like hang signs that says "drop off your daughters here," it's not just sexually suggestive, it's actually sexually violent suggestive. And we do see that there's sometimes an unwillingness among peer groups to intervene. We know that many men in that fraternity were probably very uncomfortable with that action. And then the few who chose to take that action and kind of send a message about entitlement. And we're not just talking about being welcoming to women in the house. This is a very clear message about what you can do with fraternity, with young women in a fraternity house, and speaks to, I think, the real work of prevention, which is enhancing the skills of those who might otherwise remain silent and who, in fact, are maybe the majority, who have healthier attitudes about gender and sex.
And Michael, you wanted to say something too?
No, I couldn't agree more with what Carmen said. I think that what these propose very often is what's underlying them is this notion that sex is adversarial. It's men against women, and women will hold out as long as they can, and men will keep going and keep trying, and that if men win, women lose, and vice versa. And that, of course, bears very little relationship to actual sexual behavior on the part of real grown-ups. But here's the thing that I think is really important to think about these banners. There's two things. One is that it implies or suggests a conspiratorial relationship between men. And that relationship is between the fathers who are dropping off their daughters and the guys. So I would add one thing to what Carmen said. What I would like to do is I would like to send this banner to the fathers of the frat boys. I want the fathers to see what their sons are actually saying to other fathers. Because you know what? A lot of these guys have sisters. And when the fathers see that they're basically being asked to volunteer their girls up as, you know, as fodder for this male, you know, sort of sexual entitlement machine, I think they're going to be a little bit unhappy.
It's interesting you mentioned the father connection. There are other stories like this out there in the news right now, one from Ohio State University, where a banner at a off-campus house read something like, "Dads, drop off your daughters," or "Dads will take it from here," I think is what it said. So if we think this is just
we'll
isolated, it's not.
And I'm just looking at one, you know, they're all over the internet. There's another one that says, "Thank you, fathers, for your freshman daughters." You know, so all of these things. And I have to say, you know, there is a notion. There was a wonderful article in the Onion a couple of weeks ago that the headline was, "Eminem is really upset because his daughter is dating a guy who grew up on Eminem's music." You know, when men think as fathers, they often feel somewhat protective. I think, you know, for all of the political reasons why that might be problematic for us, I think that's important to interrupt this conversation between young men and the dads.
Now, Carmen, is there something about fraternities here? Now, this was an off-campus house at Old Dominion where several fraternity members lived, but it was not a frat house in and of itself. But is there something about fraternities that you think promotes this kind of thinking or this kind of behavior?
So we have some mixed evidence about whether or not membership in a fraternity increases the likelihood of perpetration. We have some mixed evidence about that. So some studies say absolutely a disproportionate amount of fraternity men commit sexual violence, and some studies counter that. But what I think we can know is that when all male groups convene, we have dominant norms of masculinity that reaffirm one another. Those norms reaffirm one another. And oftentimes on the backs of what it is to be a man, which is to be anything that is not even remotely feminine, vulnerable, is about physical strength, sexual prowess, the ability to get both money and sex as a tool to redefine that masculinity. And so is there a problem with fraternities? Well, the problem with fraternities is that they are a fodder for leadership and real opportunity for men to discover male friendships, male communities, healthy expressions of masculinities. And oftentimes what we hear about them, justly so, because many of them participate in behaviors like this, is skews towards hypermasculine, dangerous behaviors rather than at balancing it with the opportunity they have to redefine and reshape and hold each other accountable to healthier expressions of masculinity.
Veronica, I would just add one quick thing to what Carmen said, and I think, you know, that is a very balanced and nuanced answer, that there's some evidence that says yes and some evidence that says no. I think that where the evidence points is that there's nothing inherent about being in a Greek that leads to greater levels of sexual assault. But here are the structural features. Take away the Greek letters. You have all male residential, a residential house whose parties are completely free of university administrative scrutiny. Now, if you have a party in a dorm, you usually have an RA there. But in a party in a fraternity or an off-campus house, You very rarely do. And why? Because the national drinking age is 21. 9/10 of the people there are under 21, and they're all drunk. So if a university official is actually at present at the party, they would see illegal behavior, and they would have a positive obligation to report, which they don't want to do, so they stay away. So it's no grown-up scrutiny. It's an all-male environment in which there's a lot of alcohol. Now, you tell me the places on campus where you're likely to find that, and I will show you the places where sexual assault is higher, more likely. It has nothing to do with Greek letters. In fact, I think the Greek letters can often be used as a corrective against sexual assault if done properly. When I work with fraternities, for example, I go in and I say, bring me your charter. And they bring the charter in, and I'm sitting there saying, I don't see the part where it says, you know, get women so drunk that they fall, that they pass out and have sex with them. I don't see the part where you give girls, you know, drugs. I don't see those parts. What I see is that you consider yourself gentlemen, that you believe in honor, integrity, that you are good citizens, and that's the whole idea of this fraternity is to mold men of honor and gentlemen. I said, so you're betraying your own ideas of who you are. If you participate in this, I want to hold them accountable, not to my ideas of what it means to be a man, but to their own.
We're talking right now to UW-Madison violence prevention specialist Carmen Hotved and gender studies expert Michael Kimmel about sexual assault culture on college campuses. This conversation today was inspired by sexually suggestive signs displayed at a Virginia University off-campus house. And we're going to take a caller now. We have Mark joining us in Madison. Mark, hi.
Yeah, hi. I really don't know what's going on with the government as far as all this, the funding, but I think every male and female freshman, when they come into any university coast to coast, sign some type of an agreement with a monetary penalty of some type of sexual assault, and then have some type of self-defense for women, that's mandatory, and also put more blue light kiosk with the panic button phones, have them more, you know, more square footage of those available outside in the middle of the night, and have a buddy system where there are no females out in the middle of the night, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, drunk or not, walking by themselves. I mean, there's really common sense, simple things that can be done without a lot of money. And there's also things that will cost some money, and we don't really know where it's going to come from. But
Mark, thank you for that call. And Mark saying some simple, cost-effective things you think would help, among them self-defense classes, another women not walking alone. Michael, does that put the onus on women themselves to defend themselves and to walk? What do you think about gearing it that way?
I'm certainly fine with, you know, women being more, feeling more, in, you know, empowered physically, you know, more safety, more lights on campus, all of those things. But, you know, I just offered you three variables that are structural variables: the all-male house, alcohol, and away from adult scrutiny. So what if I were to say, why don't we tinker with those structural variables? Why don't we say, why doesn't University of Wisconsin-Madison say, just as an experiment, that for the next 2 years, only sororities can serve alcohol at parties. Fraternities can't. Now, currently at UW, only the fraternities serve alcohol at parties. And in fact, the fraternity members pay us $400 or $500 each in addition to their dues for liability insurance, because everybody, you know, because the house gets trashed every few months. So my feeling is this: why don't we tinker with one of the structural variables? From now on, only sororities can serve alcohol at parties. Now, what will that do? I think what that'll do is that will mean that, for the women, if they're so drunk that they can barely stand up, if they go upstairs, it's to their own room. Number two, you know, the women will be at the door deciding who gets in, rather than men at the door deciding which maid is hot enough and drinks well enough and dances enough and has sex enough the way they want them to get into their party. So it seems to me that this would reverse the power. Now, would this eliminate sexual assault? Certainly not. Would it result in other problems? Most likely. But my sense is it's worth a shot. It's worth a shot to tinker with these structural variables. I think university administrators ought to be at every party. But then they would be witnessing illegal behavior. So that is a real issue that I think we have to confront. And there are numerous university presidents around the country who are arguing in favor of reducing the drinking age to 18 because they think that would actually reduce sexual assault on campus.
We're talking right now.
Because it would mean more grown-up scrutiny.
Talking with gender studies expert Michael Kimmel about assault culture, sexual assault culture on college campuses. Also with us, Carmen Hotfett from UW-Madison. She's a violence prevention specialist. And we're talking about that culture after suggestive signs displayed at a Virginia University off-campus house. Reopen this conversation.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think would need to change to help prevent sexual violence at college campuses, to change the culture on campuses? And have you experienced this firsthand as an administrator, as a student on campus? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a minute, but first, a check of the news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion about sexual violence on campus with Carmen Hotfett from UW-Madison and Michael Kimmel from Stony Brook University.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a student now, what do you see happening at your school? What do you say about sexual assault to your children? If you're a parent, when they head off to college, have you ever personally experienced sexual violence on a college campus? Call now at 800-642-1234, or you can share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go back to our callers now. We have Mary joining us next from Stoughton. Mary, hi.
Hi. I wanted to react to a recent caller who suggested that solving the problem might be putting more burden on women, like requiring them to take self-defense and requiring them to be buddied up, you know, when they're walking anywhere on campus. And I mean, to see how ridiculous that is to blame the victims of the assaults, I would suggest instead that we put a curfew on all men. At 8 p.m. they need to be home. I can't go out.
All right, Mary, appreciate your call. Get a couple different perspectives there that we heard from the last caller saying women need to take self-defense, buddy up. Mary saying, well, let's put the burden on the men. So is this an active debate about where the blame lies and what's going on with that, Carmen, right now on campus?
Well, I don't know that it's an active debate. I think the jury is out, and only doing work that targets individual women to protect themselves is no longer considered. It's still done, but it's no longer considered to be a good practice in addressing the societal epidemic of sexual violence on college campuses. And of course, we want women to feel empowered, and a self-defense class is a method to do that. That is great. We also don't want to send a message that sexual assault is inevitable. And to some extent, mandating self-defense courses helps to contribute to the idea that that it's inevitable, it's not preventable, and that you're responsible if you somehow didn't have the right move or see the right red flag. So things we are doing are increasing the capacity of people who aren't potential perpetrators or aren't potential victims to really look at their capacity to intervene in those dangerous situations. I'd love to hear Michael's response to that.
Michael?
Carmen's absolutely right, of course. And I just want to respond to the caller because I think her idea of the curfew actually reveals the poverty of suggestions that women simply, you know, sort of navigate their way better and smarter and have more safety and have guys walk them home from the library and all of that. And I've always thought, you know, the analogy is like, If you're thinking that this is like a jungle and it's really dangerous, you would basically, you know, if the wild animals from the zoo got loose and were wandering around the streets of Madison, you wouldn't say, you know, oh, well, you know, too bad. You would say, stay in your house. We will round them up and then it will be safe to go back out. You know, it seems to me that while a curfew for men is equally implausible as individually saying to women, well, you should just arm yourself. Those are equally implausible solutions, but they reveal the social problem that we're asking women to solve the problem that is basically a problem of men.
Well, appreciate your call, Mary. And we're going to go next to Anne. Anne is joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I'm a professor at a college that does have a fraternity system, and I see no benefit whatsoever. My most disruptive students, my poorest students, male students are 9 out of 10 times fraternity members. I think it encourages bad behavior on a number of levels. And also, I'm a mother of a young woman who's a senior in high school and looking at colleges, and she has doesn't want to go anywhere where there even is a fraternity system. She believes, you know, she's heard so many stories of rape, of terrible situations, and she wants nothing to do with it. So I think the whole system, I don't see one positive benefit to anybody of the system, and I think it should be eliminated.
Anne, thank you for the call. And we also had a comment on the Central Time Facebook page, a listener who wanted to know why there were fraternities allowed in the first place. So, Michael and Carmen, the two of you were talking about maybe some positive benefits, but is there an argument to be made, Michael, that fraternities be abolished?
I'm sure there are arguments to be made. I think that, you know, to be discussing whether or not fraternity should exist on campus, I think Carmen would agree, will distract us from the question of all men's responsibility for ending sexual assault. This is not a fraternity issue, and if we consider it a fraternity issue or a fraternity issue alone, we run the risk, I believe, of letting everybody else off the hook. Well, I'm not in a fraternity, so it doesn't bother me. I'm just in a dorm. And so I think we need to make this an issue about masculinity, about male entitlement to women's bodies, to men using women as a kind of currency in their conversations with other men, to say, you know, like guys who will pregame in their dorms or in their frats or on their sports teams or wherever, they'll pregame and they'll say, okay, I'm going to score with this, you know, with this one, and I'm keeping score. The other guys, you know, on the Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon, you know, sort of discussion about the party, and they all talk about the different women that they've had. You know, to me, what's most troubling is that women, you know, you really want to see what gender inequality looks like. Women are the currency by which men keep score with each other about their place in a male hierarchy. Now, that may be more exaggerated in fraternities, but I think it's distracting to the conversation about sexual assault if what we talk about only is whether or not fraternities should exist.
So, Carmen, you had mentioned getting people involved as people who could intervene, bystander interventions. Alongside that conversation, is there one to be had about rethinking ideas of masculinity and steering that ship maybe in a different direction than it sometimes goes?
Absolutely. And so that's one of the easiest ways to intervene is to live out a healthy masculinity, so to be a bystander by intervening in a culture that says men with feelings aren't real men, as a form of intervention, cultural intervention in its own right. I also kind of wanted to return to the idea, I agree with Michael. If we get caught in the fraternity question, we are sidetracking. We're also not acknowledging a couple other realities. Sexual assault is happening in places beyond fraternity houses and wild parties and bars. Mm-hmm. It is happening at the hands of folks people are dating. It's happening in LGBT relationships. It's happening when there's alcohol and when there's not alcohol. And so I think the distraction argument, I just appreciate there. I think one of the things parents can do as they prepare their students to come to campus is really look at what are the existing resources for survivors? What is the attitude and framework about the tolerance of sexual violence on campus? And what is the campus doing both programmatically and policy-wise to mitigate those contributing factors? Campuses, parents and students can go to the notalone.gov website to find out where the resources are and what campus policies are. UW-Madison, like many campuses, has a first-year ed program. It starts the conversation about naming the realities rather than the myths of these crimes. We've also put out a parent handbook this year at evocevoke.wisc.edu. You can access that. It is really a guide for parents to think about the conversations they can have to normalize consent and healthy gender relationships before students are coming to campus. We know that sexual assault survivors are more likely to disclose and get help from a parent who's had some sort of positive interaction around health and sexuality, sexual experiences, who's going to try to mitigate that shame and stigma survivors often feel and sometimes then don't get to participate in their educational opportunity.
And we have to leave it there. Carmen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Michael, thanks to you as well.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
We were speaking with Carmen Hotfed, Assistant Director for Violence Prevention for the program End Violence on Campus for University Health Services at UW-Madison. Also with us, Michael Kimmel, Professor of Sociology and Gender Studies and Executive Director of the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities at Stony Brook University. They joined us to talk about the culture of sexual assault on college campuses.